disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, April 19th, 2019. In this episode, we present two interviews, one with somebody involved in the Free Masonique campaign, which is fighting in Columbus, Ohio, to get murder charges dropped against Masonique Saunders, who after police shot and killed her boyfriend, was then incredibly charged with his death. We then speak to two people involved in the Arizona 3 case, which centers around three University of Arizona students who are facing charges simply for protesting the Border Patrol on their campus. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. In New Mexico, members of the far-right border militia, United Constitutional Patriots, claim that they have apprehended and stopped upwards of 3,500 asylum seekers at the border, holding them at gunpoint, and then turning them over to the Border Patrol. Many of these migrants are sadly children. The leader of the militia claims that the stops are nothing more than a verbal citizen's arrest and that many of the children they are stopping are in fact being trafficked and not taken across the border by their parents. However, videos show that militia members are running down women and children who have just crossed many miles and are attempting to apply for asylum status, and the militia members are corralling them with high-powered weapons. Emerging in 1924, the Border Patrol was an attempt by organized nativist and white supremacist forces to police Mexican migrants on the border who worked heavily in U.S. industry and agriculture. Historians have noted the high crossover between the early Border Patrol formations and the KKK, its culture of brutality and harassment, and the ongoing legacy it has of violence. Shane Bauer, a journalist for Mother Jones who infiltrated a border militia several years ago, also noted the degree in which Border Patrol and far-right militia groups coordinate with each other to trap migrants. Posting on Twitter, the account Leftkist has posted several videos from live streams of the border militia as it detained migrants and forced them to wait for the Border Patrol to pick them up. In one video, a militia member hears a dog bark and says, "Those are Border Patrol dogs. Those dogs are hungry." Gavin Clarkson, a former Trump appointee, was even recorded alongside several highly armed militia members wearing masks. Members of the militia group state that they have more contacts within the Trump administration. Meanwhile, in New York, people held a march and a rally in memory of multiple young African-American men who have been found dead in the last few years under suspicious circumstances, all of them having been involved in the Ferguson uprising. Last night in New Haven, Connecticut, people took to the streets for the third night in a row in the wake of the police shooting of Stephanie Washington, who was just sitting in her car unarmed with her boyfriend at the time when police unleashed a barrage of bullets at their vehicle, hitting Washington in the face, although luckily she survived. Police claim that they were responding to a robbery call and released nearby video contradicts their initial statements about the shooting and shows police coming out of their car and opening fire. According to one report, quote, on Wednesday, protesters stormed the Hamden Police Department demanding the officer who shot Stephanie be fired and for officials to release body cam video of the shooting. Other protests broke out on Wednesday at the scene of the shooting and outside the home of the Yale president. At the county jail outside of Atlanta, Georgia, where it's going down, reported on last week, actions continued against horrific conditions. One group of prisoners placed up a sign that simply read in a window, "Mold." Members of the Teardown community, a local group, alongside others, handed out free food outside the jail and collected stories, while a speakout was organized tonight. Upwards of 500 teens and young adults converged in downtown Chicago as part of a flash mob. Police made upwards of 30 arrests. News outlets report that this is just the latest in a series of such lawless gatherings. In Sacramento, anti-fascists wheat-pasted up posters around the neighborhood of a local far-right organizer, known for stating at a Joey Gibson rally that the heads of immigrants should be bashed into the concrete. They wrote on Facebook, quote, "Last week we put up 40 posters of Jeffrey Perrine in the Orangevale neighborhood, and last night we put up another 30. We plan on heading out to Orangevale regularly to put up these posters in Jeffrey's neighborhood and all over the town." Meanwhile, in Long Beach, California, tenants have launched a rent strike in the face of a mass eviction. And finally, in Seattle, students and faculty organized a walkout against cuts to community colleges. And now for some upcoming events. On April 19th through the 21st, in Prescott, Arizona, there's a three-day anti-fascist gathering. On April 21st, there is a rally in Chicago against the expansion of a child detention complex. On April 27th, there is a march against an anti-immigrant rally in Huntington Beach. On April 27th, there is an all-out mobilization against the white nationalist Patriot Militia holding a rally in Long Beach. On May 1st, there are May Day actions planned across the world and the so-called U.S. Be sure to watch IGD next week for more info and a list of events. On May 4th, there is an all-out mobilization against an anti-Muslim group in Toronto. On May 18th, there is a mobilization against the White Nationalist American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee. On May 25th, there is a mass mobilization against the KKK in downtown Dayton, Ohio. From May 18th to May 19th, there is the Revolutionary Organizing Against Racism or ROAR Conference happening in the Bay Area of California. In June, be sure to look out for Running Down the Walls events that will be happening to benefit Anarchist Black Cross chapters. Be sure to watch It's Going Down. We'll be putting together a list. From June 14th through the 17th, the Fight Toxic Prisons Conference is happening in Gainesville, Florida. On June 19th, there is a mobilization against the National Solutions White Power Conference in Tennessee. On August 3rd through the 11th, the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking is hosting a gathering in Worcester, Massachusetts. And on August 16th through the 18th, the Indigenous Anarchist Convergence is happening in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona. That's going to do it for us. As always, enjoy the interviews and we will see you soon.
Yeah, my name is Clementine. I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio, and I use they, them pronouns.
Awesome. Thanks for calling in. So we're going to be talking about a campaign that's been going on for a while now, been following each other on social media, and we're excited to have you on to talk about this campaign. So just tell us about just the background and the story to this.
Right. So early December in 2018, in a setup by Columbus SWAT, Julius Tate Jr. was murdered, and it was very shady, like all police killings are, the way that it happened. And it was 6 days after the murder of Julius Tate Jr. that his girlfriend at the time, Masonique Saunders, was arrested, which raised a lot of concerns from folks because typically, if there is any sort of suspicion of a crime, they would do it immediately. So the fact that they waited 6 days for her raises a lot of concerns. And she's currently being charged with aggravated robbery and felony murder. And felony murder is a particularly fucked up charge because Masonique was not the person who killed Julius Tate Jr., but because under this felony murder law, because she was present at the time, quote unquote, a crime was committed and violence was used in order to stop that crime from being committed, she was technically, she technically shoulders some of that responsibility legally. So, as a way to avoid accountability for another one of their murders, Columbus police are now pinning the crime on Masonique. So she is currently still sitting in jail with these trumped up charges and had a court date scheduled for, I believe, late January or early February. But then that got postponed to early May. So the way that the coalition kind of came about, we were originally organizing around Julius's case and trying to get him and his family justice. But because we suffered a lot of loss here in our community, momentum fell off around that. Sort of as we came back together as a group of organizers, we recognized, well, not recognized, but sort of wanted to uphold the fact that Masonique also had stakes were high for her as well in this case. So we wanted to organize around her and do whatever we could to get her free, and have since been putting on a bunch of different fundraisers, events, meetings, and actions to raise awareness and put pressure on the system to get her out.
So the police killed this 16-year-old young man, and then six mm-hmm. days later they charged Masonique with his murder. What is the police Correct. Narrative? Like, what are they saying? What are they putting out?
Right. So the police, of course, are doing what they can to smear both of the folks involved, both Julius and Masonique. They said that they pulled the gun on Julius and shot him because he was intending on robbing them. And they also say that they recovered a gun from the scene. But in a lot of articles that came out around the time of the murder, people were saying that they actually didn't recover a gun at the scene, that they actually had to go inside a house and pulled one out there. And the fact also related to the fact that they waited 6 days for Masonique. A lot of folks were under the impression that the reason why they wanted to take her in for this murder is because she was going to give testimony contradicting the police's narrative.
They're not debating the fact that they shot Julius, but they're
they're not debating that fact. They're owning up to the fact that they shot Julius. But they're saying that they've been just rationalizing it, saying that he intended to rob them, so they killed him, and they are now making Masonique responsible for this crime because they say that she was present while this alleged robbery was underway.
How does that even... I'm sorry, that just seems so bizarre. They're saying that she is responsible for mm-hmm. his death, even though they shot him.
Yes, that is exactly the facts of the case, is that they are charging her for Julius's murder, even though they pulled the trigger, and they admit to having done so.
Okay, and that's because she was in proximity to him, and because, I mean, everybody wants to rob the police, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm. the best people to rob. How are they arguing that these people were intending to rob police? These are, like, I'm assuming police officers in uniforms, right?
No, actually. So this is something that they started doing at the end of last year. Prior to the Julius Tate murder, there was another instance of this where SWAT officers will go online posing to, I think, be selling something, understanding that the folks that they're contacting are planning on robbing them. So it's a form of entrapment where they'll go set up an exchange, and then when this person tries to rob them, then they are within their right as police officers to stop that crime from happening. So in this case, they shot Julius. It was all an undercover sting and a setup. Gotcha. Set up by SWAT. So they sort of entrapped him in this situation and then responded violently, as they were expecting to. And this happened literally a week after the same thing happened to Kyler Collier, who was shot in a SWAT sting under almost identical circumstances. Kyler survived that shooting, but is now sitting in behind bars for armed robbery charges.
Are there other examples that you know of where somebody has, like, Masonique, like, been charged with a murder just for being... I mean, I've heard of people, like, in a car where, like, a drive-by shooting might happen, and even though they didn't mm-hmm. pull the trigger, they'll still be, you know, charged with murder. I've heard of that, but I've never mm-hmm. heard of a case like this.
Right. Yeah, there is one other case like this that I'm familiar with out of Alabama. Is it Alabama? Yes, Alabama, with Lakeith Smith. Lakeith Smith just recently, I think, got sentenced to 65 years in prison for a killing that he didn't commit. And I think Alabama also has similar laws around, like, felony murder and accomplice liability. So even though the police shot somebody, Lakeith Smith is now guilty, quote-unquote, for that crime.
Wow.
And will serve time for it. Yeah.
How much is Masonique facing?
I'm unsure of how much time she's facing, but they are There's talks that she might be tried as an adult, which certainly doesn't fare well for her case. And since these are, you know, fairly violent crimes, I imagine that the time wouldn't be short. And because the system doesn't really have much regard for Black life, I wouldn't be optimistic that the sentence in that case was long, would be short. So that's why we're doing what we can as a group of organizers, also in collaboration with her and her family, to get her free and get Ron O'Brien to drop the charges. But based off of his career of letting killer cops go free regularly, without much accountability there, you know, we're up against a lot.
Yeah, let's kind of turn back towards the campaign if you want to talk a little bit about some of the actions or demonstrations or just any sort of organizing that's gone into this, if you want to highlight that.
Right, yeah. So over the past few months now, we've been organizing a wide range of different activities and events. So one of the first few ones, we had a letter writing event where we just encourage people to come through and write letters of support to Masonique, just letting folks know that we cared about her and that, you know, we're doing what we can to get her out of there, and just trying to uplift her spirits as she's, you know, she's grieving behind bars. It's not just that she's like, she's not just that she's been wrongfully incarcerated, but she's also like grieving the death of her boyfriend and recently also had to celebrate a birthday behind bars. So we had a letter writing campaign. We've also put together a petition that we're circulating that we're planning on dropping off to Ron O'Brien sometime soon. Most recently, we had a fundraiser where we featured art from local artists and had live performances. But I think the action that sort of helped us get a lot of momentum recently is the march and noise demonstration that we hosted. So we gathered at a local park. It was some of us who were in the Coalition to Free Masonique more officially, as well as other outraged community members. We gathered at a local park and then marched to the juvenile jail where Masonique is being held. And we all had different like whistles, instruments, pots and pans, like kazoos and trombones or whatever. And we're just trying to make as much noise as possible on the way there, but especially outside the jail, so that Masonique and all of the other youth who are inside know that there are people fighting against, you know, incarceration and trying to certainly get her out of there. When we arrived outside the jail, we had a group large enough to block the street. So we held the street for probably about 5 minutes before Columbus police rolled up in force. And they really brought out there was about 50 of us there, and they had probably about like 20 police officers on the scene with just as many cruisers. And so in that blockade, one of our comrades was arrested, and they began to threaten arrest for everyone who was standing in the street if we didn't move. So we eventually, just because our comrade was in custody, we moved off to the side of the road again and checked in on him. And then we marched around to the other side of the jail where we made lots of noise again. And gave more speeches, addressed Masonique directly. And there was still a very high police presence at that time, clearly intimidated by the people power. And I think they were also potentially worried that we were going to take the highway afterwards, which we didn't do. So, you know, I think that was a really good space and a really, you know, powerful action. And, you know, we're hoping that Masonique was able to hear us, and she did get advance notice that we would be doing the noise demo. So, you know, it's just going to be onwards and upwards from here. Tomorrow, we are having a national call to Free Masonique, where folks from all over the nation can call in and discuss ways that they can be in solidarity from wherever they are. We're trying to have folks host different solidarity actions during the upcoming week of action, National Week of Action, which will be May 3rd to May 10th, because Masonique's court date is either on the 7th or the 9th. So we want to have a lot of national attention and momentum building around that time, in hopes that if he hasn't dropped them by then, that Ron O'Brien will drop the charges at that point. So, you know, coming up past the call, we're probably just going to have like weekly actions for people to participate in, whether that's calling into Ron O'Brien's office or writing letters to Masonique or Ron O'Brien. Or we might, you know, encourage people to do speak outs, teach-ins, whatever they can do that's in their capacity. And then once the court date happens, we'll know where we're going from there. But we're going to just keep on going until Masonique is free and all of her charges are dropped.
Well, that's great. Yeah, hopefully people listening to this, the next time you see something online about a call-in campaign, you'll feel moved to get involved, even if you're not in the local area and you can't attend a demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking at, there's a great website. Unfortunately, what it publishes is the numbers of people that have been killed by police, but it's killedbypolice.net. Mm-hmm. The last time it was updated was a couple days ago in April. It says 264 people have been shot and killed by police in 2019.
Wow.
Last time I did the math on this, it's still under the same amount, about 3 or 3.5 people per day that are killed by police, and that's been about the average for the last couple of years. It seems like things under Trump have just continued at the same rate or even accelerated a little bit.
Yeah, it's relentless. And, you know, not to say that police violence is unique to the Trump administration, because sure, it certainly has existed well before him. But he definitely also represents like the white supremacist and classist violence that policing upholds. So it could certainly stand to reason that things have only begun to speed up with him in power.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how people can follow the struggle in terms of just social media accounts. I know you all have pretty active Instagrams, mm-hmm, and Twitter, and also there's a hashtag too that people should follow.
Yeah, so for social media, and that is Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, you can find us at Free Masonique. So that's FreeMasonique. And the hashtag is the same, hashtag Free Masonique. Also, if you're tweeting anything, hashtag drop the charges as well. And then there is a website where you can find us, freemasonique.home.blog, where we try to update regularly about things that are going on. If you have any questions or concerns, you can also email us at freemasonique@gmail.com.
Awesome. Anything else that you want to touch on in terms of the campaign or anything else?
No, I think I would just really encourage people to, you know, stay up on all the different things that we'll be sharing in the next few weeks. Definitely get engaged with this case, and, you know, also encouraging people to get engaged with cases like this that are happening around them locally. Not even cases like this, but, you know, this organizing around anti-racism, anti-policing sort of work, so that, you know, Black girls don't have to sit behind bars, or, you know, folks don't have communities to go back to because they've been affected by state violence. So just encouraging people to do that work and stay updated with all the different things we'll be doing.
Awesome. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
The questions that many of you have are the same questions that we're asking.
They took Freddie, life wasn't really that serious. Now they got the whole city real furious. Fuck the police, that don't really mean it's no good. No, we don't need they service. They worry about the drugs, need to worry about the murders. Niggas getting shot, they act like they ain't heard it. This shit full of clowns, they belong in a circus. Made me wanna whack all of them on purpose. Until we get justice, we out here thugging. They done took a young nigga life for nothing. Took it from his family, they should've just cuffed him. Then they hit the nerd and threw it in front of the public. It could've been you, it could've been me. Cause while I'm standing tall, protesting on these streets. Fuck the police, they don't bring us no peace. So we gon' make sure they don't get no sleep. Fuck them.
Fuck them. Fuck them, man. Fuck them. They don't want that racist shit like we from Madden. swear I can't stand the law. And they wonder why, cause it's fucked up, cause they going on a murderer, so who a nigga pulled the claw? And they get away with anything, like there would've been some black men, bet they would've been behind bars. Tell the truth, they don't really care about no black males, they don't wanna see it make it fall. So it's fucked. And that's the model, until they give us some justice. Pray for his family, cause they deserve that. God bless them.
My name is Mariana Coles Curtis. I am a graduate student in poetry. I'm getting an MFA at the University of Arizona, and I'm facing criminal charges for speaking out against the presence of Border Patrol on campus.
And I'm Fernando Najera. I am a DACA student here at the University of Arizona, graduating this May in political science and an undergraduate in law.
We're going to kind of get into some of the broader history and details about all this stuff in a bit. But let's just go back to how this started in terms of, you know, the protest itself, how the charges came out of that. Just take us back to the beginning of how this all unfolded.
Yeah, totally. So this all started on March 19th when the Criminal Justice Club at University of Arizona invited Border Patrol to come give basically what I think was going to be a job talk to their club. And they didn't notify anyone about Border Patrol coming. And myself and two other students decided to speak up about their presence on campus and make sure that they knew that they were not welcome on campus. So the UAPD, the police department showed up, and for a long time they just watched us. At a certain point, they closed the door and told us not to open the door, and we were very respectful of that and did not open the door. And at no point during their presence there did they tell us that they saw our actions as anything remotely illegal. This video went viral, and the Friday following the incident, the president sent a really neutral email to campus, that, you know, it was very much a politician's email and said absolutely nothing, but certainly was not condemning our actions. Then Robbins, the president, met with the head of the local union chapter of the National Border Patrol Council, whose name is Art Del Puerto. And this is a guy who has made open threats to undocumented students on campus. He's asked for people to send him the names and addresses of quote-unquote illegal aliens on campus, and he says that he'll show up at their homes. He also threatened to punch one of the other students who spoke out against the presence of Border Patrol. So following this meeting, President Robbins sent out an email announcing to campus that the students would be facing charges and that the dean's office would be looking into code of conduct violations. And the email is just sort of like wonderfully transparent about his motives. The very first paragraph just starts by saying, I'm writing to affirm the University of Arizona's relationship with the women and men serving in U.S. Customs and Border Protection. So it's sort of, yeah, wonderfully clear what his priorities are, which are reaffirming this relationship with Border Patrol and not protecting students' right to free speech. So that's sort of a basic synopsis of some of what's been going on here.
So how did this turn into such a big deal? Because it sounds like a couple people just protesting against the Border Patrol on campus. How did this kind of blow up in the news media?
Yeah, right. So I think it's obvious that, you know, we're living through a very a polarized time in United States history. Especially when it comes to immigration enforcement. Here at the border, it's even more heightened, right? We know that Border Patrol has the right to be and patrol land that is 100 miles away from the international border. And that's where our campus resides, right? It is within those 100 miles. So here in this region, you know, this is is a big issue for us. So it's not really a surprise to us that this blew up. But it is important to note, like Mariana said, that Art Del Cueto's statements, incendiary statements, had a really important role and this growing to where it is now, it's important that we're like analyzing to what capacity they played in getting the charges on the three students who spoke out against. Because up until his statements asking the university to investigate and consider pressing charges, like Mariana said, the university president's tone was fairly neutral. And so I think, in my opinion, Art del Cueto is the primary reason why this has gained so much national coverage, and why the three students have faced so much danger. You know, we know that they've received death threats from many, many outlets, and followers of Art del Cueto.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think also that, you know, it has blown up in terms of community support and campus support, as well as just national support for the students, because these charges are clearly, you know, very bogus. Like, literally, we were just speaking out about Border Patrol on campus. There was nothing illegal about what we did. And I think that these charges pose a very serious threat to free speech on campus in general, but specifically speech that is, you know, targeting law enforcement agencies.
And I'm sure you're aware that recently, you know, young Republican activists met with Donald Trump. In fact, some of them have kind of their foot within the alt-right. And Trump passed a resolution, supposedly in support of free campus.
Right.
This is just a couple months ago, or about a month ago.
Yeah, I think it was actually a day after the free speech executive order came out the day before Border Patrol was on campus.
Yeah, exactly. So he signed that executive order literally the day before that that the three students spoke out against the Border Patrol agents on campus, and then now they're being charged. So also that, you know, there is a correlation with that as well.
And I mean, has anybody brought that up, that like, hey, there's an executive order on campus or for campuses to respect free speech? But I mean, everybody knows that you all are not, you know, who that's intended to protect. But has anybody brought that up at all?
I mean, people are talking about it. But yeah, I think, you know, that executive order maybe is actually like intended to target us in a negative way. Yeah, I think there's, you know, maybe some correlation there. Like, clearly it's the same team, like, trying to crack down in different ways on the ability of people who oppose these institutions to speak out.
For the people that are pushing the charges, what is their argument? Like, what are they trying to say why you should be charged with this?
Yeah, well, we are being charged with the disruption of the peaceful functioning of an educational institution, something like that. Yeah. So I think that they're, you know, arguing that we in some way infringed on the ability of, you know, these students to learn from Border Patrol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we keep hearing this, like, this phrase, right, where it's okay to protest, but it's not okay to disrupt. And I think that that's like their major premise, right? That like, well, you're allowed to speak up for what you believe in as long as nobody can hear you, right? Mm-hmm. As long as you're not interfering with my right to listen to agents who work for an agency that murders, that rapes, that steals, you're not allowed to do that, right? So yeah, I think that's important to consider as well, that, you know, the group who wants these charges to be seen through, definitely their intentions are to silence, and it's very clear.
Historically, what's been the interplay between the university itself and the Border Patrol?
So actually, we have audio from Art del Cueto stating how much money this university receives from the Department of Homeland Security. We know that they've always had a very friendly relationship, but also we know that student organizers have been fighting very hard for their CBP presence to be limited or banned from our campus. Specifically, students here at our Immigrant Student Resource Center have been working to implement policy that is of like a rapid response policy whenever Border Patrol is on campus. Our demands to get them banned on campus have been met with the excuse that this is public property, right? Public space. So they're allowed to be on campus, that it's illegal to ban them. So we have decided to rather implement rapid response policies where we are notified whenever they are on campus, where, you know, the Dean of Students has a liaison between any agent who needs to speak to students who are in danger by their presence. But also, I think it's really important to note that Tohono O'odham students and individuals from our community have been continuously asking for their presence to be banned from our university at the University of Arizona. The University of Arizona does reside on Tohono O'odham land, and the trauma that, you know, having these agents on campus relives to these students when they know that these agents, you know, cause a lot of harm to their community that resides along the border, is always important for us to highlight that it's not only undocumented and documented people who are impacted by their presence on campus, but also the people who actually originate from this land.
Yeah, I just want to return to, I mean, you know, if this becomes the norm, I think it's very scary, because they can say that anything that potentially, you know, quote, disrupts, you know, the flow of the university or stops people from learning or whatever. I mean, that gets into the question of like, even like things like, you know, holding a sign or, you know, giving a speech outside, you know, beyond anything that's like, you know, demonstrably like disruptive. Just seems to be, again, like whittling away actually like what people can actually do to express themselves, which is very frightening. And again, a very ironic, like in this context of, you know, the right pushing forward this, you know, conspiracy theory that somehow they are the ones being attacked on college campuses.
Yeah, totally. And I think, I mean, if we're going to talk about disruption, the Border Patrol presence on campus is what I think is much more disruptive to students' actual ability to learn. Like Fernando said, I mean, people have experienced a lot of like personal trauma with Border Patrol, whether they're, yeah, like undocumented, documented, or just brown people living within 100 miles of the border. So I think that, you know, a lot of people see Border Patrol agents and they get terrified. Even, you know, there's a white professor who's spoken out about how his class is in that building, and his immediate inability to focus on his class was just about terror for his own students, like afraid that Border Patrol was going to come to the door and start trying to take students out of the classroom. And he was like, what would I do? And he was unable to teach his class. And that had absolutely nothing to do with the fact that there were students, you know, speaking out about that presence. Mm-hmm.
Obi, we could turn now and talk about some of the solidarity and, you know, other actions that have taken place since, you know, these charges kind of first came down the pipe. What have students been doing? I know there's been a lot of different demonstrations that have been happening. I know at different college campuses, not just the one that this originated from. If you could kind of talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, yeah, Tucson has a great tradition of community solidarity. We know that, you know, this is one of the birthplaces of the sanctuary movement here in the United States. So we have a great tradition of activism and advocacy. And very appropriately, since these events transpired, and especially since the charges were placed on the three students, this campus has been organizing pretty much every night, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what's next. We know that we want to give a huge shout out to ASU, right? They've been protesting in solidarity with us as well. And so it's great to see not only our strong local solidarity and support, but also, you know, even throughout the state.
Yeah, I think also, you know, faculty support on campus has been really great. There is a letter delivery action, and I think around 300 people, 400 maybe, came and delivered letters to the president's office. Folks have attended a Board of Regents meeting and held a rally afterwards. And, you know, that was primarily students who are, you know, wanting to tell. We packed the Board of Regents meeting. They had to open up the room to create more space for us. And yeah, I think there's more things that are, you know,
to come. Coming. Yeah. One of the things that I really think is important to highlight is the way that the university is trying to capitalize off of the trauma that these students are living from this event by hosting campus conversation events where they're trying to demonstrate, quote unquote, the right way to have dialogue with one another when there is disagreements. And so they're trying to capitalize off of this with like civility discourses, which I think is disgusting, right? Like we have three students, two women of color, and a very courageous ally facing charges and facing death threats and, you know, facing academic consequences as well, right? Academic sanctions. And they are trying to fill up auditoriums with community members where their, you know, hand elected panelists talk about bullshit conversation pieces, right? So I think it's also important to highlight that because I think it's wrong that they're trying to capitalize off of these events like that.
What's going to happen next for the campaign just coming up? I mean, what do you all see needs to happen in terms of making sure that these charges are dropped?
Yeah, so currently we have a call-in campaign against the Pima County attorney, Barbara LaWall, where we're asking folks to pretty much by the end of today call in and get everybody they know to call in demanding that these charges are dropped. The first arraignment hearing for two out of the three students being charged is Monday, this upcoming Monday, the 22nd. So we want to get in as many calls, get as much traffic on those lines to show the solidarity and support for the students, as well as just the fact that these claims are bogus. So that's where we're at right now. But, you know, this is an ongoing campaign. We know that even if these charges are dropped, the real issue here is, or one of the biggest issues here, because there's many, is that CBP and ICE needs to be off of our campuses. And, you know, this is what these students spoke out for. And I think that it's still at the center of our campaign. You know, even if these charges are dropped, we need to continue organizing to limit them from our campus, or at least, you know, implement procedures that will keep our students safe.
Well, I think the last question is, how can people keep up with the struggle, and also where can people go to get more information to just kind of stay up with news and how they can get involved?
Right. So on Facebook, there is a page called the Coalition for the Arizona 3, where we're posting events that are upcoming as well as news, you know, from the press or even from ourselves. We're also on Twitter with the same handle. But really, I think the biggest thing we can do for the three of the students who are being charged is to send these letters of support to, by the end of today, you know, really make sure that we're continuing this call-in campaign. We know that the third and final arraignment hearing is on the 25th. So we want to continue pressuring, you know. But yeah, the biggest way to keep up is the Coalition for the Arizona 3 on Facebook and Twitter.
And I mean, I think we also just want to encourage students at other universities and anyone who is involved in an institution in any way to create initiatives that will keep Border Patrol, if you're close to the border, and ICE, if you're not, although ICE both ways, off out of those public spaces. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say that, you know, on the same day that this incident with Border Patrol happened on campus, a family was detained in Tucson after a routine traffic stop by Arizona Highway Patrol. they called Border Patrol. And luckily we have a rapid response network in Tucson, so people were able to show up and film it. One person actually even crawled under the Border Patrol truck to keep it from taking off. But unfortunately, this family, a mother, a father, and a 12-year-old girl, were taken into Border Patrol custody. They were separated from each other and held in freezing and extremely overcrowded conditions at the Border Patrol headquarters in Tucson. And at the end of those two nights, the father was deported to Mexico without any kind of hearing. So I think, you know, that is just like a lesson that we can learn from that, is that any interaction with law enforcement can lead to detention for folks who don't have papers, and detention can lead to family separation, sexual abuse, and death, as we've seen in recent months, deaths in the hands of in Border Patrol custody. So, you know, I think that to protect our undocumented community members, we need to limit as much as possible interactions with law enforcement. And I guess just, yeah, like support us by doing your own shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, you know, also important to note that that family detention happened less than 3 miles away from our campus while we had agents on our campus. So, you know, this is very, this is very real on campus and outside, which is even more scary. But yeah, just taking space and, you know, if you're an ally, be as courageous as, you know, Mariana was and just be there, because we know that anytime we're speaking out, right, especially in this time, we're risking some sort of punishment. But that doesn't mean it's right that you're being punished, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't let your voice be heard.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.